You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
Alexander Newley, the British artist best known for his Portrait of a Portrait type paintings of some of the world's well-known faces across theatreland, has bravely confronted his singular biggest influence in a new memoir, a peripatetic abandoned childhood as the only son of Hollywood movie star Joan Collins and Oscar-winning composer, stage genius and entertainer Anthony Newley. The book is called Unaccompanied Minor, and I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Alexander Newley to the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Very good, sir. I think we'll start with a kind of obvious question, but I'm not sure the answer for you is obvious. Most people say when they write a book, something like this, that the actual process involved in writing it is the catharsis. But I think for you, it's actually the release of the book, isn't it?
Yes, actually, the writing of the book is one part of the catharsis, and then the releasing of the book into the world is obviously another part of that, and getting feedback from people on the story and how they feel the story comes across. That's a very, very important part of the process as well.
Yes, I mean, and the story's taken a while for you to tell, so how long did the book take to come up with?
Well, I wanted to write the book for a very long time, but the actual writing of it took about a year and a half. Mm. And that was about three or four years ago. But obviously I've been, you know, processing and thinking about my childhood for a very long time.
Yeah.
And I just felt that it's, you know, with such an extraordinary childhood, growing up as the son of these two amazing people, Ben Connors and Anthony Newley, during such a fascinating period in popular culture, you know, the late 60s into the 70s, and my dad was this meteoric star, you know, UK-based, who, you know, was born illegitimate in the East End, and then 30 years later he's taken Broadway by storm with two musicals, and he's living in Beverly Hills, you know, and with, you know, it's just like this great Gatsby kind of existence, with, you know, my mom creating these amazing parties with everybody from, you know, Paul Newman to Sammy Davis Jr., Natalie Wood, all, you know, and I remember this because I took their coats at the door, you know, I was part of this whole world, and, you know, this book is really me kind of pinching myself, thinking, did this all really happen? You know, was my best friend Geoffrey Moore, who was actually Roger Moore's son, yeah, while Roger was James Bond? Me and Geoffrey were playing Escape from Colditz in the grounds of Roger's house. I mean, crazy stories like that. Just convinced me that I had to tell this story.
Yeah, I mean, it is an extraordinary story, and of course, it itself ironically reads a bit like a movie script. 1963 is when Joan Collins married Anthony Newley. That was her second marriage,
yes.
And that's an interesting thing in itself because she effectively put her career on the back burner to focus on family, didn't she?
She did, yes, to her great credit. She, you know, Dad was a hugely famous man at that time. So she, and she wanted very much to be, you know, the good wife at home and the good mother and so on. But the thing is that all of her best friends, like, you know, Natalie Wood and Diane Cannon and so on, were doing movies at that time. So it was very difficult for her, knowing that, you know, she was arguably as beautiful, if not more talented, that, you know, she was sitting at home. And so I think she really wanted to get out there as well, which is fair enough, you know.
Absolutely. And the fascinating thing about entering into that marriage was your father was very honest. He had warned your mother that he didn't think he could remain faithful. But even on that basis, she went ahead.
Well, he also said, and this is important, that he was going to give it, a very good shot. Because I think he realized that in my mother, he had found something enormously special. You know, I mean, she really was at that time. You know, everything was there, the incredible charisma, the talent, the beauty, you know, and she was just a bombshell on many levels. And I knew I just think my father realized, wow, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be with this extraordinary human being. And he said, listen, I know, I like the girls, but I'm going to put all that aside, and I'm going to commit to this. Sadly, it didn't last, but, you know.
The actual story of how they got together, you tell, and Robert Wagner was the man who was actually your mother's beau at the time, and your father effectively nicked your mum from Robert Wagner, to put it too fine a point on it.
He did. I don't think RJ, which is everybody's nickname for Bob Wagner, realised what was going on. And there's a passage in the book in which I describe how Dad basically, I think, seduced both of them with his sense of humour, you know. But when he gave my mum a hug goodnight that night, I think she realised, and I think RJ, by that point, the penny had dropped, that something magical had happened between these two and that they would be seeing each other again.
Amazing. And they became effectively the Brangelina of the day. I mean, it was really only Burton and Taylor, wasn't it, that outpeered them?
That's right. I mean, take your pick. Any, you know, I don't know, Harry or Meghan, if that's not too exalted. But they were the it couple in Hollywood at that time. You know, they would walk into restaurants and I'm not kidding you, people would stand up and start applauding. Because Dad was such a humongous figure in musical theatre, and he'd just done, you know, Doctor Doolittle, and so yes, it was very, very illustrious. And I, in the book, I try as much as possible to evoke the glamour and the sparkle of that time in the late 60s, when you know, it was Camelot. It was really quite extraordinary.
Many people listening to the show, myself included, came from families which could be described as difficult, but we didn't necessarily have to deal with the ogre called show business, which loomed very large in their lives, and that really was the ogre for them, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, you know, they had to chase the work, whether it was in London's West End, whether it was in Hollywood, or whether they had to go on location. You know, show business is a major taskmaster, and to stay ahead of the curve, you have to go wherever it's happening, which is not the best situation in which to bring up kids who always need security. On the other hand, it was a very rich and exciting life, because I was exposed to so many new experiences all the time. And yes, they were away, and yes, I was blue sometimes because I didn't see enough of them. But when they came back, they sure made up for it. You know, my mother was always bringing me wonderful things. You know, she was making a movie in Japan. She'd bring me back this amazing kimono. And, you know, there was always a sense of excitement to do with this, all this traveling. But, yeah, there wasn't enough security.
Did it make you and your sister very much closer because you had a kind of shared problem?
Yes. Yes, there was certainly a point later on where we got very close, because both my parents went on to puff this new, they had new marriages and new children. So Tara and I, at that point, I think we clung to each other, because we had been on this journey together. And I think we saw in each other, you know, a sort of vital sense of security. So yes, that became very important. Yeah.
Just discuss your father for a moment. I mean, nowadays, I imagine we would very tidily put him in a box called sex addict, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the 60s and 70s, as we know, was that free love was to the fore. Everybody was following their bliss. It was a very free, experimental time. I think looking back on it from now, where we know a lot much more about, you know, there's a positive freedom, and then sometimes there's irresponsible freedom. And I think there was a lot of that in the 60s. But that was part of a world in Hollywood and which was full of men behaving like that. And perhaps now in the Weinstein thing, we see the final, you know, the end of that kind of Hollywood. But it was a very free time. Women were looked upon as, you know, it was a score here, there, and everywhere. And so Dad was a very sexual man. He was a very creative man. And so he really enjoyed himself in the late 60s. The women and the girls loved him, and he loved them right back.
Did they argue at all about your mother putting her career on the back burner?
Yes, I think so, because, you know, she is not the sort of woman to stay home. She's electric, she's hugely talented, she's got so much charisma. And she just had to get out there. And I think he finally realized that, he had to, you know, step aside and let her be who she was, and for the health of the marriage.
You tell a lot of incredible stories in the book. I mean, you describe one at your house in Summit Drive, which your mum did a total makeover of, and you ended up you ended up face down in the pool, which can't have been too impressive.
Well, yes, there was one of those amazing Hollywood parties that they would have around the pool, and everybody was there. Streisand was there, Billy Wilder, you know, Paul Newman. And everybody was having such a good time. I fell into the pool, and nobody noticed until the last minute when I was actually, you know, beginning to sink. And then my father dove in and saved me, and my father almost fainted into Paul Newman's arms. You know, she was so stressed about it. But, yeah, that's a sort of funny, tragicomic moment in the book.
We all, I think, who've had divorced parents remember the actual day that our mother and father all individually came to us and, you know, and explained what was going to go on. And you described that in the book, you know, that they both sat you down, which I imagine was quite important, but it's something that never goes away, that memory, is it?
It doesn't. And, you know, again, I think a lot depends on the age you are when that happens. If as a child you have to go, I mean, I was so young, I don't think I really understood what was happening. And at the end of that passage in the book, I just say, can I go back and play now?
Yes.
Because I think it only dawned on me 3 or 4 years later, by the time I got to 7, 8 years old. Wow, what happened? The world has fundamentally changed. So for me, it was a sort of delayed realization of what had happened. I think they were very conscious about it, and I'm grateful for that.
Absolutely. And of course, life changed for you then. You moved to London, which you don't remember very much about. But then Ron Cass, who was very big at Apple, came very large into your life. Did you see much of your father? Because you were effectively living with your mum then, weren't you?
Yeah. I mean, the reason I chose the title Unaccompanied Minors is there was quite a lot of jetting back and forth between London and L.A., with that funny laminated sign that kids have to wear that says unaccompanied minor. At least that's the sign I used to wear. So I would go out and I would see him at summer times, which were absolutely blissful. And sometimes he would come to London. He was in London in the early 70s for his for rehearsals for his musical Good Old Battle Days. So I certainly saw him then. But yeah, he's even after the divorce, he's a huge, huge figure in my childhood, always.
Well, that's good to hear. And you tell of your life in London, which sounds just pretty much just about as crazy as it was in L.A. I mean, there you are at Ringo Starr's house in Hampstead at Guy Fawkes Night. There's all kinds of stuff going on around you. It must have been mind-numbing for you as a child.
Well, as a child, you don't have anything to compare it to. You don't know what normal is, obviously. You take your world for granted. You think this is normal.
Yeah.
But my mum, wherever my mum went, and that's true even now, she creates a stir. She creates a happening. So when she took up with Ron in London and he was head of Apple, she created, again, this huge scene and everybody came to our parties. You know, Dirty Fire came, Peter Sellers, all of these wonderful people. And I just remember, you know, saying goodnight to Mum before these parties started, and then going upstairs, and then hearing all the laughter and the music downstairs, and going out on the landing, and just you know, absorbing all this joy that was just wafting up from below. And then the next morning, I'd go in and I'd inspect the living room after the party, you know, and things like that. But I was absolutely fascinated by this scene, and I knew, I think intuitively, that the people that were in my mother's and Ron's life were extra special because, you know, charisma is charisma. Even children understand that. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think everybody, all kids feel that their mum and dad are movie stars or film stars. Or big, you know, I mean, it's just so happens that in my case, everybody thought my parents were a big deal, you know?
And of course, the general public think that they know people because of what they perceive them to be from the work that they've done on the television and in film. And of course, I guess with your mother, many people thought that she portrayed Alexis Carrington in real life.
Yeah, I mean, Alexis is an extraordinary creation. I mean, let's face it, it's one of the most enduring creations in popular culture in the last, you know, quarter century. But, you know, I know the side of Mum that is vulnerable and sweet and darling, and that, you know, so I know front stage and I know backstage, you know, and I know how they all go together. And I think that part of the book is creating a total 360-degree portrait of both my mother and father, and showing how the humanity links together into the public persona, you know?
Yes.
I find that very interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you mentioned portraits there, and it's important to mention that 20 of your own artworks are depicting the people who played a pivotal role in your early years are in the book.
Yes. Yes, absolutely, yeah. The work is important. The paintings are important because I think they elucidate moments in the text and vice versa. And I thought it was interesting to have a memoir, rather than have photographs in it, have the paintings in it. Mm. And it's worked beautifully. I'm so happy with the look of the book. It's just, it came together beautifully.
And a difficult question to answer, I'm sure, but would your father be proud reading the book, or would it maybe prick his conscience a little?
There might be a bit of both, but I think overall he'd be proud, because Dad was fearless. You know, that was part of his greatness as an artist. He was not ashamed to show who and what he was and declare it openly. And the power of his art is because people can so relate to the honesty and the authenticity of who he was. So I think the fact that I have been able to tell my truth and to celebrate my truth, and it's a very, I think, ultimately positive truth, he'd be very proud of me for that.
That's good to hear. Let's finish with a little local angle. I notice with interest that one of your Christmas cards, I think it was back in 1972, showed you by the pool of your holiday villa in Marbella.
Yes, yes. My mother and Ron had, for many years, a wonderful summer house down in Marbella, and we would go down. This is before, you know, Marbella really blew up.
Sure.
Where it has now. And there was one place called the Marbella Club, which was great.
Still there, still there.
Yeah, is it really?
Absolutely.
Well, and I just remember one long, wonderful summers at that house in Marbella, very happy summers. And, of course, all my mum's friends from London came down and, you know, listened to Sergio Mendes by the pool and drank too much sangria, you know, and all of that wonderful.
Lovely, lovely story. Yeah. Well, the book is Unaccompanied Minor. Alexander, it's been an absolute privilege to talk to you, sir. I know you're a very busy man. We'll let you go. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Cheers, Em. Bye-bye.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.